On the 31st of August, another official communique stated, the Egyptian Fedayeen have begun their activities inside the territory of Israel after repeated clashes on the border during the past week. The Egyptian Fedayeen have penetrated into Israel settlements spread out in the Negev unto Beersheba and Migdal Ashkelon at a distance of 40 kilometers from the Egyptian border, and have taught our aggressive enemies a lesson that they will not forget. The Egyptian Fedayeen sowed fear and consternation amongst the citizens of Israel. And on the 2nd of September, the following official statement was broadcast in Cairo. The forces of the Egyptian Fedayeen moved towards Israel, approached her capital, and caused heavy casualties along the border between Gaza and Tel Aviv. These, Mr. President, are some of the documents which mark the origin of the Fedayeen movement. United Nations authorities repeatedly condemned these activities, designated them as aggression, held the Egyptian government responsible for them, called for their cessation. As one example, I quote a statement at that time by the United Nations Chief of Staff, General Burns, reporting to the Security Council, he wrote, the episode of August was soon followed by an organized series of attacks on vehicles, installations, and persons carried out by gangs of marauders in Israeli territory, which, according to my information, resulted in the deaths of 11 military and civilian personnel. The number and nature of these acts of sabotage perpetrated well within the territory of Israel are such as to suggest that they are the work of organized and well-trained groups. That was the opening shot in the Fedayeen offensive in the summer of 1955. In the spring of this year, the activity of these groups took on a new scope and intensity. This was the period during which the arms race, initiated by Colonel Nasser with external help, was running most drastically to Israel's disadvantage. Members of the General Assembly will recall how close we were then to the threshold of general war, while these units came in and out of Israel every day on their missions of murder and plunder, accompanied by the official exhortations of Colonel Nasser and his officials, and by exuberant shouts of triumph in all the media of Arab information. In an address to the Security Council last week, I submitted a detailed chronicle of acts of violence carried out by penetrating Fedayeen units day by day and night by night in the period between April of this year and a few days ago. Throughout the whole of that period, United Nations officials concerned with security on our frontier were devoting great attention to this problem. On the 8th of April this year, the United Nations Chief of Staff had addressed a letter to the Foreign Minister of Israel. In this letter, General Burns includes the following passages: I will dispatch to the Foreign Minister of Egypt a protest against the action of the Fedayeen, assuming it to have been authorized or tolerated by Egyptian authorities, and requesting the immediate withdrawal of any persons under Egyptian control from the territory of Israel. I consider, said General Burns, that if Egypt has ordered these Fedayeen raids, she has now put herself in the position of the aggressor. I will not weary the General Assembly with this sordid chronicle in all its details. Suffice it to say that during this period of Egyptian belligerency, there have taken place against Israel 435 cases of armed incursion, nearly 2,000 cases of armed robbery and theft, 1,300 cases of armed clashes with Egyptian armed forces, 172 cases of sabotage perpetrated by Egyptian military units and Fedayeen in Israel. As a result of these activities, 465 of our people have been killed and wounded. In 1956 alone so far, as a result of this one aspect of Egyptian belligerency, 28 of our people have been killed and 127 have been wounded. I have said that this activity is merely the spearhead of Egyptian belligerency. It is a new device for making war and for making it with safety. The doctrine is one of unilateral belligerency. The Egyptian-Israeli frontier is to be a one-way street. It is to be wide open for these armed Egyptian units to penetrate deeply into Israel, to accomplish their mission and to return, it is to be closed in their favor against any defensive response. It was in these circumstances that the government of Israel faced the tormenting problems of its duties and obligations under the Charter of the United Nations. We are not satisfied with a justification of our actions in pure terms of national expediency. There is perhaps no member of this organization more sensitive to all the currents of international opinion, more vulnerable to the disfavor and the dissent of friendly world opinion, broader in the scope and extent of its universal associations, less able to maintain its life and its existence on any principle of self-sufficiency and of autarky. It was within a full knowledge of this fact that we have been forced to interpret Article 51 of the Charter as furnishing both a legal and a moral basis for such defensive action as is literally and specifically applicable to the dangers which we face. Under Article 51 of the Charter, the right of self-defense is described as inherent. In the French translation, naturel, it is something which emerges from the very nature of a state and of humanity. This inherent right of self-defense is conditioned in the Charter by the existence of armed attacks against a member state. Can anyone say that this long and uninterrupted series of encroachments did not constitute in its totality the essence and the reality of an armed attack? Can it seriously be suggested that we made no attempt to exhaust peaceful remedy? Time after time at the table of the Security Council and in meetings of the Mixed Armistice Commission, efforts were made to bring about tranquility on this frontier. And yet all of this well-intentioned, enlightened, and at certain times hopeful effort ended without making the life or the security of a single citizen of Israel greater than it was before. I've mentioned the problem of opinion. It is perhaps natural that a country should interpret its own obligations for the preservation of security more stringently than those who enjoy greater security far away. If we have sometimes found it difficult to persuade even our friends in the international community to understand the motives for our action, this is because nobody in the world community is in Israel's position. How many other nations have had hundreds of their citizens killed over these years by the armed action of armies across the frontier? How many nations have had their ships seized and their cargoes confiscated in international waterways? How many nations find the pursuit of their daily tasks to be a matter of daily and perpetual hazard? In how many countries does every single citizen going about his duties feel the icy wind of his own vulnerability? It might perhaps require an unusual measure of humility and imagination for others to answer the question how they would have acted in our place. Nobody else is in our place and is therefore fully competent to equate the advantage and the disadvantage of our choice. The government of Israel is firmly convinced that we have done what any other nation would have done in our place, with the reservation that many would have done it earlier and perhaps with greater impact of resistance. It is especially moving to us to find that despite the uniqueness and eccentricity of our position, something of it is making its way into the generous consciousness of mankind. Since this discussion proceeds not merely from the rostrum of the General Assembly, but also against the bar of world opinion, it is, I think, legitimate to quote an eloquent and a cogent passage from one of the great organs of opinion published in this, the host city of our organization. In yesterday's edition of the New York Times, "It would be ridiculous," it wrote, to permit Colonel Nasser to pose before the United Nations or the world as the innocent victim of aggression, or to hold a protecting hand over him. On the contrary, insofar as there is any one man guilty of aggression, it is the Egyptian president, for he has waged war against Israel, Britain, and France by gun running, by propaganda, by infiltration of murderous bands, by stirring up rebellion in Africa, by seizing the Suez Canal with force and scrapping a treaty in the same manner in which Hitler marched into the Rhineland, by blocking the canal for Israeli shipping in defiance of United Nations orders, finally by the whole loudly proclaimed program of throwing Israel into the sea in alliance with other states and creating an Arab empire extending his hegemony, which would expand his influence in concentric circles to all Africa and to the whole Muslim world. In these circumstances, Mr. President, both the position and the attitude of the Israel government are clear. The attitude is based upon our fundamental concept of reciprocity. If the frontier between Egypt and Israel is to protect Egyptian territory against Israeli entry, then it must protect Israeli territory against Egyptian entry. We hold it as a self-evident truth that the lives of Israeli men, women, and children are not less sacrosanct or less worthy of international protection than are the lives of the hired Fedayeen groups, which are the main instruments of Nasserism in its assault upon the peace and the decencies of Middle Eastern life. Beyond these incidents, grave as they are, we discern issues of even greater moment. World opinion must surely choose between the two candidates for its confidence. On the one hand, the farmers and workers, the men, women, and children of Israel. On the other hand, the fanatic warriors of the Fedayeen groups. Behind that confrontation, there stands the much broader and more significant alignment between Israel and Nasser. A small people builds its society and culture in its renascent homeland. In the early days of its independence, it is set upon by the armed might of all its neighbors who attempt to wipe it off the face of the earth. In the following years, its neighbors continue their assault. With warlike acts of their own choice, they attempt her destruction by armed intervention. They send armed units into her territory to murder and plunder. They strive by every means to ensure that nowhere shall there be tranquility for peaceful pursuits. They blare forth the most violent threats of Israel's destruction. They accumulate vast armaments for bringing this about. They announce, as they did last week from Cairo, that it is they who will choose the time and the place for the final assault, and that it is for us to wait passively for the moment of their selection. They proclaim that a state of war with Israel already exists. They seize the greatest of the world's international waterways and convert it into an instrument for unilateral national pressure. Across Africa and Asia, wherever Nasserism spreads its baneful influence, it works actively to subvert all peace and progress and to establish an ambitious and insatiable hegemony. Now, having considered that it has humbled and defeated the international community and the maritime powers, Nasser's action returns to its first target, Israel, which is to be swamped from three sides with a new wave of Fedayeen violence. For the Assembly will recall that the new wave began shortly following the tripartite military alliance concerted 10 days ago between the governments of Syria, Jordan, and Egypt under Egypt's control. Mr. President, while studying with attention all proposals for strengthening security in the Middle East, we must reject with vehement indignation the charges of aggression launched against us here, launched by some states whose own current international and security activities are well in the forefront of today's international attention. There is aggression, there is belligerency in the Middle East, but we for 8 years have been its victims, not its authors. That is what I mean when I say that world opinion, as here represented, should decide whom to trust. Shall it be the small free people establishing its homeland in peace and constructive progress, Or shall it be the dictatorship which has bullied and blustered and blackmailed its way across the international life of our times, threatening peace in many continents, openly avowing belligerency, placing its fist on the jugular vein of the world's communications, bringing the Middle East and the world ever nearer to the threshold of conflict, intimidating all those who stand in its path, all except one people at least which will not be intimidated, one people whom no dictator has ever intimidated, the people which has risen up against all the tyrants of history, the people which knows that the appeasement of despots yields nothing but an uneasy respite, and that a government which allowed its own citizens to be murdered daily in their homes would lose the dignity and the justification for which governments are instituted amongst men. In conclusion, Mr. President, I would ask the General Assembly to believe that Israel, the Arab states, the region in which they and we must forever live, now stand at a crossroads of their history. An aggressive dictatorship has, for the first time, encountered successful and glorious resistance. Some elements of its pride have been broken. Those whom he has outraged with impunity have stood up and asserted their rights. And the hope of freedom burns brighter in the Middle East today, not only for Israel, but for many others in our region, who have found ways of communicating to us their own deep apprehensions of what Nasser's encroachment means for their own cherished sovereignty. If the power of this tyranny is not artificially revived, our region will again become a place where men of all nations, including Israel, can live and work in peace, where legitimate universal interests will be respected under the sanction of law, where contracts with other lands will be held in respect, where all those in Asia and Europe whose fortune is linked by history and geography with the Middle East will receive justice and respect for their legitimate interests. It will be a region where the great maritime nations will not have to suffer the indignities which they underwent in this building last month, when they had to hang with exaggerated deference on every wave of the hand, on every nod of condescension from the representative of the territorial power, which had converted the unconditional right of navigation into an act of grace or privilege to be conferred or withheld at will. Such a Middle East, free from domination and totalitarian influence, will enter perhaps soon upon its new birth of freedom. This is the crossroad at which we might soon stand. We could have wished that we had reached it less drastically, with smaller peril and sacrifice. But having reached it, surely we must go forward and not back. This momentous discussion today has made it plain that one thing will not do. It will not do to go back to an outdated and crumbling armistice regime, designed by its authors to last for a few months and now lingering for 8 years in growing paralysis of function. Least of all can we be satisfied to return to an imperfect armistice, distorted by unilateral belligerency, to a system designed 7 years ago as a transition to peace and interpreted for 7 years by one of the parties as a continuing state of war. Israel has no desire or intention to wield arms beyond the limits of her legitimate defensive mission. But whatever is demanded of us by way of restoring Egypt's rights and respecting Egypt's security under international law must surely be accompanied by equally binding Egyptian undertakings to respect Israel's security and Israel's rights under the identical law, Egypt's obligation to abstain from acts of hostility, to liquidate its commando activities, to abolish its illicit discrimination against Israeli shipping in the Suez Canal and in the Gulf of Aqaba, is equal and identical in law to Israel's obligation to respect the established armistice lines. Our signpost is not backward to belligerency, but forward to peace. Whatever Israel is now asked to do for Egypt must have its counterpart in Egypt's reciprocal duty to give Israel the plenitude of her rights. beyond the moment when fire will cease, the prospect must be not one of unilateral claims by one party against the other. The horizon must be of peace by agreement, peace without maritime blockades in the Gulf or in the Canal, peace without frontier raids or commando incursions, peace without constant threats to the integrity or independence of any state, peace without military alliances directed against Israel's independence. Egypt and Israel are two people whose encounters in history have been so rich and fruitful for mankind. Surely they must take their journey from this solemn moment towards these horizons of peace. Thank you.